Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
We are definitely car-based today because Jackie Ickx, his authorized competition history, is the new book by John Saltonstall. Jackie is one of the true greats of motor racing in a career spanning nearly 40 years. He was highly successful and hugely versatile, racing in a wide range of categories, including Formula One, sports cars, touring cars, and rally raids, and winning throughout. He won Le Mans 24 six times and twice finished runner-up in the Formula One World Championship. Here to tell us more about him and the book is the author of Jackie Ickx's authorized competition history, John Saltonstall. John, good afternoon to you. Good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, good afternoon, Giles. It's great to be back talking to you, and thanks again for inviting me.
No, the pleasure's all mine. Last time we spoke, it was about Niki Lauda, wasn't it, I think?
It was indeed, yes. Similar sort of book, although didn't have Niki's collaboration on that one. This one's been rather different.
Yeah, indeed. Now, if you know your motor racing, I mean, Jackie Ickx is one of the all-time greats. I mean, he really is, because he was quick and he was, as I said, versatile, because the range of stuff that he raced and raced successfully.
Absolutely. I mean, the eclecticism of his career is one of the things that fascinated me and kind of led me into the project in the first place. You know, the book itself was kind of an unintended consequence of the reaction to the Lauda book. Having sort of done the Lauda book where I thought, if somebody thinks it's good enough to publish and somebody else thinks it's good enough to buy, my work is done. I'd never really got any plans to go beyond that, but the reaction was so positive that the publishers asked me if I'd consider doing another one, and Jackie was very much on the list of people to consider purely because of that eclecticism. As you say, it's not just that he raced in a lot of categories. He was highly successful in them, but, you know, let's not forget, before he started racing cars, he was a motorcycle trials rider, you know, twice won the Belgian Trials Championship, competing against a guy who a lot of people might have heard of, Roger da Costa, you know, multiple motocross world champion. Was, you know, Jackie used to beat, they kind of used to beat each other in the early 60s in trials. But the guy who gave him his break in that was also an importer of who imported Zundert motorcycles, also imported BMW cars into Belgium. And he lent Jackie his own BMW 700 that he'd been doing a few circuit races with for Jackie to hill climb. And almost immediately, Jackie was a winner. So he went from sort of hill climbing in 1963 to winning Grand Prix for Ferrari in 1968. You know, it was a meteoric rise, really, as well.
Yeah, I mean, he really was the wonder kid, wasn't he? We talk about the hot thing, young thing on the book, but he's also got film star looks. And I mean, he's a good look. He was a very handsome young man, and he's distinguished, shall we say, now as well.
So he's an incredibly cool guy, isn't he? I mean, you see him now, and he exudes cool.
But like you said, but it was almost as if he was you could say equally blessed and cursed, because he had that. It's interesting you do Niki Lauda, because Lauda's always going to be linked with Ferrari, and Ickx was a really important part of Ferrari. But it's his F1 career is a story of the Nearly Man, and had he won, and he might have won here, and he might have won there. And you think of that, you know, he's runner up in 1970, where the world championship is won by Rindt in the most tragic circumstances. He becomes the first posthumous world champion, and Ickx can't get the title even with the number of races left. And then he has those other races in the early 70s with Ferrari, and then he falls out of grace with the old man. And he goes to, and then his F1 career seems to be with teams that are just past, you know, are going just about to go into a dip into form, like Lotus, for example.
He had an almost Chris Amon like skill of being in the wrong place at the wrong time, or the right place at the wrong time. It's quite interesting when you look at, I mean, he's, because obviously his first runner up in the world championship in 69, he was driving for Brabham.
Yeah.
And was, you know, very much being touted in 69, 70 as the next, you know, he was going to be a champion. You know, everybody was talking of him in those terms. If the world championship had been run between June 1970 and June 1971, he would have won it. In terms of his sort of his record within that period, and that, you know, that I guess it's the case for many drivers. But you're right. When he left Ferrari in 73. Strangely enough, his relationship with the old man was still pretty good.
Yeah, and let's not forget this Ferrari in 73 was an absolute pig of a car.
Oh, it was a complete dog of a car. Mauro Forghieri, Ferrari's designer, had fallen out of favour for various reasons. And Enzo had the 73 car built in Britain by John McDonald, specialist mouldings or whatever they're called. And it was a real pile of crap.
Yeah, and that's a technical term for it, John, as well. That's
absolutely, you know. Yeah. But by the end of the summer, Jackie had basically said, if we can't sort this thing out, then I'm going to take a sabbatical. So he had, if you like, agreed a leave of absence, because he was still he'd been driving for them in sports cars. So he did one race for McLaren, which was a good story in itself, because once he left Ferrari, he wasn't particularly going anywhere. He hadn't got another Formula One drive in mind. He got sports car commitments, he's got touring car commitments, but he hadn't got another Formula One drive in mind. So Alistair Caldwell, the team manager at McLaren, and a mechanic called Leo Weibrot hatched a plot. They started a paddock rumour at the Dutch Grand Prix that Jackie was going to drive for them at the Nürburgring. And they did it within earshot of a Belgian journalist called Pierre Van Vliet, who picked it up and phoned Jackie, who was at home in Brussels at the time, and said, what's the story here? You better get yourself down here. So Jackie drove over from Brussels to Zandvoort, went and met Teddy Mayer, McLaren boss, in his caravan in the paddock at Zandvoort. Mayer knew nothing of this story either. Mayer wasn't party to this bit of subterfuge. And they agreed terms to do a one-off race, or at least an initial race at the Nürburgring. Obviously, it was great for McLaren because Ickx was a Nürburgring specialist.
Yeah, absolutely.
It wasn't such great news for Denny Hulme and Peter Revson, McLaren's regular drivers, because Ickx was immediately a lot quicker than they were in the M23. Out-qualified them both, and they weren't too thrilled about the fact. There's an apocryphal story going around that McLaren overfueled the car and detuned the engine, which Alistair Caldwell tells me isn't true, but he did tell me that it is true that they put him on hard tyres.
Right.
Which meant that he couldn't compete with the Tyrrells. So the Tyrrells sort of came first and second, and Jackie came third, a long, long way ahead of the other two McLaren guys. And the McLaren mechanics absolutely loved him. And Jackie thought he was in the pound seats for McLaren for 1974 and had negotiated a deal with them, particularly because Texaco were going to be sponsors for McLaren in 1974. Jackie was big pals with John Goossens, who was the boss of Texaco. In fact, Goossens had co-written a book with Jackie in 1970, and they later did some rallying together. But for whatever reason, Jackie introduced Emerson Fittipaldi to John Goossens as, you know, he's the other guy you should be having with me.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
And it ended up that all of a sudden Jackie was marginalised. Emo went to McLaren and Jackie suddenly didn't have a seat. The conversations that he'd been having with Tyrrell, because he'd driven for Ken Tyrrell in Formula 2 in the 1960s, very successfully. And he'd started talking to Tyrrell about a drive for 73. But by this time, Tyrrell had already signed, they signed Jerry Birrell, who got killed, but they'd signed Chetra Depailler. So he couldn't really go there. So he's looking around, where do I go? Well, Lotus had won the Constructors' Championship in 73. You know, they were still on winning form. It looked like a good bet.
Yeah.
So 74, they've got no money. The new car was a dog. Everybody was focused on Ronnie Peterson. And poor old Jackie is kind of left out in the cold.
We can go chapter and verse, and like I think it goes to Ensign and other bits and pieces. That's sort of after the awful sort of series in the Lotus. His F1 star. I mean, he's still a famous track specialist, but it wanes. But you mentioned, look, Formula 2. He's competitive in Formula 2 in 16 or 17. We forget now, don't we, the huge range of races. I mean, if you look at for example, Jackie Stewart's, when he wins when he's defending his world championship in 72, he's doing Grand Prix at one weekend, and then he's doing Can-Am. You know, he's flying across the pond to do that. And he eventually is doing, working so hard, he gets an ulcer, doesn't he? He gets a stomach perforation because your drivers were driving every weekend, and they were mixing it between not only perhaps you were doing an F1 and maybe an F2 race, depending on how it was thing, but Jackie's doing touring cars, and all the F1s were doing sports cars, and not just sort of three times around a safe circuit. We're talking the old Spa, the Ring, and also all these killer races like the Targa Florio as well, and these street circuits, and of course the one that is going to become Jackie's speciality is Le Mans 24 Hours, obviously.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, his record at Le Mans is, well, until Tom Christensen came along, and racing in a different era and a different kind of thing, isn't it? You know, Le Mans is a sequence of sprints now. Although Jackie was the first to congratulate Tom when he broke his record, but his incredible stamina, incredible speed. You know, some of the drives that he made, the drive in say 77, where they clawed back God knows how many laps, you know, and dragged the thing home to victory. He win in 75 with Mirage, where the car was basically falling in half because of the vibrations from the DFV. Again in the early 80s, as you get into the 962 era, you know, his name is synonymous with as Mr. Le Mans. You could argue that if his name is synonymous with any track, it's with Spa, though.
Yeah,
you know, they're about Spa as it used to be, the unsanitized Spa. 1973, fastest ever.
Yeah, but I want to take you back to 69, and I've got a personal reason. I got a connection with this one, because as I said off air, because dad was a racing driver. He's still with us, thank goodness, and a rather good one, professional. And he raced 69 at Spa, and he said it was raining. Of course, the old Spa with the fearsome Master Kink and the whole thing, right? And he said they had an agreement, because he was driving a Chevron, you know, so it's not one of the front runners. So they all had an agreement around the back that they would tootle around together, because they couldn't really see where they were going. They could see where they'd kind of been and where they were, but not where they were going. And he said lap two of the old Spa, they're all sitting there sort of quietly pootling along, getting out of everybody's way in their chevrons and their whatever else is, and suddenly the lights came up on lap two and it's Ix coming through at full pelt.
Yeah, that would be about right. In I think it's 1967, he was driving for Mirage, John Wyer's Mirage team at Spa, and it was raining. Of course it was raining. So first lap, they go, Ix is on pole, goes streaming off down the hill, out round the track, pops out through La Source at the end of lap one, down through Eau Rouge, through Lescombes, off to Butwoods Bernardville. Silence. Nobody else in sight. Crowd are looking around, thinking there's been an almighty accident somewhere that's blocked the track. 37 seconds later, Lucien Bianchi appears in second place. Sorry, Willy Meres appears in second place. Oof. 37 seconds lead on the first lap in the rain, and he just sort of went away from there. He has this sort of uncanny ability in the wet.
But also, the other thing is, he also had an idea about safety, because the Le Mans start, 1969, closest Le Mans finish ever, okay? Yeah, is that 69, 70? So I can't remember.
No, 69, you're 69, right. You're absolutely right.
And he gets, because he used to be the old style Le Mans start, i.e. the drivers would be on one side, open pit lane. I mean, the speed they were doing, open pit lane, flashing part. Anyway, everybody else leaps in the car. Some of them belt up, and some of them don't. And this becomes important later on. But Ix is famously photographed walking across. So by the time he gets into his GT40, sort of Stommelen and everybody else is gone, haven't they?
He was almost run over by some of the guys because he was still actually crossing the track as other guys were leaving.
Yeah.
So he was almost run over getting to his car before he even got into the damn thing. But as you say, he then strapped himself in and was last away by a country mile. Now, as a consequence of that, you say the people not strapped in. Yeah. At the end of the first lap, John Wolfe has a huge shunt at White House.
And he's driving the 917, which he's got customer orders. So he's been told, because he's a gentleman driver, that he really shouldn't go out on the first drive, right? They've said, please don't go out because you're not really, you're good, but you ain't that good because the 917 is a beast.
And it certainly was a beast at that stage. It was, some of the stories that Frank Gardner used to tell about, its desire to lift wheels off the track and to try and become airborne. It was not an easy thing to handle. Anyway, Wolf lost it big style at the end of the first lap. There was a huge accident, fire everywhere. Wolf was killed, bless him. Jackie was stuck in that bunch of cars that were blocked behind the accident.
Because the whole track. I mean, again, Dad said he was in the pits and Stommelen or Alfred came blasting past, and then there was this huge silence, and then they saw this huge pool of,
Absolutely. It's interesting because this was very much Jackie being his own man, wasn't it? He disagreed with the concept of the Le Mans start because he thought it was unnecessarily dangerous because of the way it was staged. It was a crowd pleaser. So he executed his protest on his own, in his own way. And that's where he and Jackie Stewart became at loggerheads, really, because Jackie disapproved of the politicisation and the way that Stewart mobilised drivers to, have industrial action against circuit owners. Ix was of the opinion, well, if you don't like the conditions in your racing, then drive to the conditions at a level that you feel comfortable with rather than boycott the place. But with something like the Le Mans start, he felt, no, I will make my own progress my way, protest my way. As you say, closest ever Le Mans finish, he ended up winning by a matter of yards. If he'd come second, everybody would have called him a clown, wouldn't they? It would have been the protest that lost it. But as it was, he won, and he was a hero.
Of course.
Incidentally, just after that race, when he was driving home after the race, through some little French country road, he got forced off the road by a tractor and crashed his Porsche 911 into the steps of a church. So he's had his safety protest at the top of the race. Goes through all of those 24 hours in whatever conditions, comes through to win it without a scratch, and then literally the next day stuffs his car into a church.
And it's a Porsche, and it's interesting because his sports car career in the 80s is Porsche.
Well, interestingly, he had actually had a go in a Porsche in 1969, but it wasn't reported because he wasn't supposed to be in it. He was... He was at the Nürburgring in 1969. I'm sure it's 69. He was testing a Mercedes Benz that he was supposed to drive at the Spa 24 Hours. Big old industrial, like the royal barge of a car.
The red pig.
Yes, absolutely. He was supposed to drive the red pig at Spa in 69, and they withdrew it because it was eating its tyres. But he'd been testing a few weeks before that. He was testing that at the Nürburgring at the same time as Porsche were testing the beast of a 917, and Kurt Ahrens was testing it. And Helmut Bott said to Jackie, do you want to have a go? Put in a few laps, tell me what it's like. Jackie's contracted to Ford and John Wire at the time.
Yeah.
He jumped in and nobody said anything, so it was never reported. But... He did eight laps. They were on the Schutzschleife with it. He did eight laps and he got out, and Kurt Ahren said to me afterwards, he'd said to Jack, why are you sweating so much, Jackie? Because he said it was an absolute pig of a thing to try and keep on the road.
Yeah, absolutely.
So his links with Porsche went all the way back to there.
But then, of course, the Rothmans Porsche, and you have this amazing period of success as well. I mean, you think of the drivers of that, Derek Bell as well, just superb drivers, and just a superb time to be. It's that golden era of Group C, isn't it, as well?
Absolutely. And, you know, even at this point, you know, sort of later on in his track racing career, Jackie's still pulling in some amazing performances. You know, his win at Brands Hatch in, I think it was 82, in the wet, where the race was split into two halves because of being stopped for bad weather, and chased down the Lanciers and managed to win by a matter of seconds, in virtuoso performance. And again, a year later at Kyle Army in the 9 hours there, where the terrible weather conditions that had forced them to spin off the road, and both he and his co-driver had done so, and that ripped the bottom off the car. You know, there's a photo in the book of, you can see daylight through it because the whole left side Venturi has been ripped off. So God knows how this thing was handling. But he still manages to drag it home enough to get him the title. So a combination of mechanical sympathy, I guess, and racecraft, as well as just speed when it was necessary. You know, he was winning multiple races. Right, well, he won his very last race, didn't he, in 85.
Yeah, I mean, and again, it's that wet weather thing as well, isn't it? Which maybe comes from having an idea about how to handle a bike as a motorbike as well. But you do find
he says that entirely because the Belgian motorcycle trial season was a winter season, so it was running snow and ice and mud and water, and it was all sort of seat of the pants, fingertip stuff. And with motorcycle trials, of course, the important thing isn't how quick you get round; it's doing it without putting your feet down. So he had balance and he had finesse that he learned from that. And he says that's what taught him about finding grip where there wasn't any.
Talk about finding grip, wasn't he? Finding roads where there aren't any. Paris-Dakar, the old Dakar, you know, the proper Dakar, if you like. It goes back, isn't it? It goes back to the trials. It goes back to be able to spot the bits of the landscape you can negotiate relatively safely.
Well, yeah, and you know, he says that, you know, because he did a bit of offshore powerboat racing in the
as you do,
as you would, you know, he did six races in the European Offshore Class II Powerboat Championship. But he says that the desert is like the sea. You know, one sand dune looks very much like another in the same way as one wave looks like another, but they're not, and you only find it when you hit them. So there's a lot of sort of stop, start finding where the grip is, finding where the road is. We know from what we read and what we Google and whatever that Jackie won the Paris-Dakar in 1983, but he actually did 30-odd rally raids. You know, he was doing the Faroes Rally, he was doing the Atlas Rally, the Baja Aragon, you know, lots and lots of really long distances. So he may not have done as many. I mean, Jackie, I think, did about 573 races. So we know that Andretti did over 900. But, you know, I don't think anybody's done more miles than Jackie.
Yeah, I mean, some of those are ovals for Andretti. I mean, come on.
And some of them are sprints.
Yeah.
You know, races that last 8 minutes. But arguably, you know, Jackie did a lot of hill climbs, which are over fairly quickly. But he obviously did dozens and dozens of endurance races, and he did a lot of rally raids. So in terms of racing miles, I think we'd be hard-pressed to find anybody in the world who's done more racing miles than he has.
But it's interesting, isn't it? Because his is a name that you wouldn't – I mean, in a world of multi-million, you know, pound sponsorship deals for everything to do with motorsport these days, if you're not an enthusiast – I mean, suppose the name will probably pass you by. I mean, so would the name Derek Bell pass you by as well. But, you know, when it comes to saying name famous Belgians, obviously I always say Jackie X and people go kind of who. But, you know, I mean, he was the poster boy, but he's not of the, like, the 60s, you know, that young guy, kid coming up. But he's as I said, he stayed cool, but he's also stayed away from the limelight in terms of he's not written about himself that much.
Well, he's refused for 35 years to do an autobiography, which kind of hampers things a little bit. And although he's, you know, he's provided forwards to books here and there. And he collaborated, as I say, with John Goossens on this book in 1970, which really talked about the earliest stage of his career, but is fairly superficial, as most things were then. But unusually for an elite athlete, he doesn't like talking about his own achievements. So you have a conversation with Jackie about, they say, oh, well, let's talk about the 1976 Le Mans win or whatever. Within 30 seconds, he'll be telling you about the mechanics or the designers or how everything is down to the people who built those cars and ran them or marshaled the tracks or whatever. He doesn't like saying, oh, yeah, I did this. It's very much against the grain with him.
So what's he kind of up to today? Because, I mean, I sort of follow him, you know, stalk him on the socials, and he seems to be enjoying himself. He does a lot of classic stuff, and he always seems to be wearing a nice watch. He's doing some branding for somewhere, and he still looks sort of super cool.
He's a brand ambassador for Chopard, and so he does a lot of work with them. And Chopard obviously sponsored Amelia, so he's normally involved with that. He's big mates with Karl Heinz, Karl Friedrich Schaufeler, who owns Chopard. But he does a lot of historic events. So, you know, you'll normally find him at Goodwood, Amelia, Le Mans Classic. And this month he's over in the States. He's doing Long Beach Grand Prix. He's doing something else over there. I know he's due to be at the Dijon or Nogaro shortly. But it's fascinating to watch him with the fans. He's brilliant with the fans, and the amount of time that he will spend with them. A lot of guys will, you know, right, I've done my hour, I'm gone. You know, the guys at Goodwood will say, well, you'd sign autographs for an hour. And they go, well, he's more, well, I'll keep signing autographs while there's a queue there. Because, you know, who knows that the guy who's next in the queue hasn't waited 3 hours to see Jimmy or hasn't flown over from Australia to see me, you know. So he's acutely aware that, you know, the everything that the drivers really earn from and get paid from is down to the fans.
And the book itself, I mean, the images, the photography, absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, we've been fortunate. Doing the first one teaches you where to look. So although we went to the usual sources that you would go to for a project like this, so, you know, you go through the usual Revs, Getty, Motorsport Images, all of this sort of people form. Over half of the images in that book we didn't pay for. They came from private archives, enthusiasts, some from the X family themselves, some stunning ones from the earliest days of his career, particularly around the hill climbing and the trials. Most of the photos actually haven't been previously published.
Well, he said it's something he hasn't seen before himself.
Well, yeah. there's a nice story attached to one of those. 1964, the Coupe des Alpes tarmac rally. If you try and find anything about that rally, you know, good luck in the first instance. But you will eventually find seven sort of newspaper reports of the 1964 Coupe des Alpes. Keep saying Coupe des Alpes, say that Pascal. Six of those reports say that Pascal drove it. One of them says that Jackie drove it, and the one that says Jackie drove it is the one that's right. Jackie had crashed his Lotus Cortina at the Coupe des Alpes, and it was being rebuilt. Pascal had been offered the drive in the Coupe des Alpes, and so Jackie needs the cockpit time, so therefore let's give him the car. So he co-drove with Julien Vernave, who is a Belgian rally driver. I've managed to find a photograph of the car on the starting ramp that was taken by a fellow called Maurice Louche, who'd developed the film but had never printed the photos. So he went and had a look through it, and he said, oh, there you go, there's one for you. So beautiful photo of the car on the starting ramp. So Jackie said, oh, can I see that? Because I've never seen it. No photos of the car. So I sent it over to him. He says, you know the story of this race? I said, well, I know that you didn't finish and that you crashed, but that's kind of as much as I know. You know, I knew the conditions had been dreadful. He says, yes, let me tell you why. He says, son. He says, so on the second day, the throttle jams open. They're in a mini. He says, on the second day, the throttle jams open. So we come to an agreement. We will keep going. Julien is driving. So Julien has the steering wheel and the gears. I have the ignition switch. So my job is when we get near a corner, I turn off. Only on one corner, I am not quick enough. And we miss the corner and we go a long way down a mountain. And the car rolls over and the roof comes in and the windows come in and we stop. And I said, Julien, get out. The car is on fire. And Julien turns to me and he says, Jackie, you are covered in the contents of the ashtray. back in the early 60s, you know, Vernet had been smoking all the way around, and yeah, Jackie got the benefit of it. And Jackie says, I have not thought of this story for 50 years. And that's the joy. It's things like that, these little sort of eureka moments that, because some odd Englishman happens to ask him about, you know, a race that nobody knows he's done, he comes up with something like that, because where else are you going to hear that?
Absolutely bleeding brilliant. Listen, John, I could talk about Jackie Hicks and this until Bleeding Wednesday, I think, next week. But I'm going to run out of time. There's a beautiful thing that Jackie said, has actually said. It says, John's research was impeccable and I couldn't have chosen better words than his. Thank you, John. Your tremendous effort. This is a book I will treasure. The book is called Jackie Hicks. Of course, it's called Jackie. Well, I've lost my notes now, John. I've lost my notes.
Authorized competition history. It's called.
There we go. Thank you very much. It was sitting there somewhere. It's all available from all the good bookstores, of course. Are you online? Can people find you online, my friend?
Yeah, they'll find the book through the usual online retailers. It's all over Amazon and the like, direct from the publishers, Evro Publishing. So evropublishing.com, you'll find it there. Or if you just Google my name, it'll come up. But it's been fun. It's a big old beast. I'll warn you. You know, your postman won't thank you for it.
He said that himself in a Facebook post, didn't he? He said it's such a big body of work, John.
Well, the manuscript was 350,000 words. So.
Whoa. That's like the Porsche 917 is a monster. Only begs one question. Come on. Well, you've done two now. What's next in your sights?
Well, the commercial realities will determine what's next, because obviously things like photo licensing and print costs have gone through the roof in the last couple of years for, you know, the way that the global economic environment is. So the publishers will be making a decision by the summer whether or not they want to commission something else. So it would probably be unfair to suggest...
To spook
it. Because just in case it doesn't happen and then you feel like you're letting people down. But suffice it to say that if you think of drivers who've got long and varied and eclectic careers and do an awful lot of races, then you get the kind of idea of the sort of people to be likely to be about.
I await your Pasta Maldonado magnum opus then any time very soon indeed.
don't expect anything about any of the current crop of F1 drivers because their careers are not eclectic.
Exactly. This book is called Jackie's Authorised Competition History. John Saltzell, it's been an absolute pleasure once again to speak to you. Have a great rest of your weekend, my friend.
Thanks so much, Charles.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints. Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.